Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those who are joining us live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. We already got a nice little core there. And it's at this point in the show where I usually start to chat about the guest we have coming online. But as most of y'all know, we don't have a guest today. We do this, I think we've done it a couple of times here in the course of the 19 months we've been doing the show. We kind of have a free-for-all. Eagle One, myself, and you with the questions. You either want to roll in on the chat page for those that have stage fright and had to move a few urinals down because it was just an issue of yours mentally and you can't call in. But you are more than welcome to call in, those that do not suffer from stage fright. And our number, if you want to call in, 347-308-8397. Again, 347-308-8397. We usually don't take callers, but hey, it's a free-for-all, so we have to open all avenues. That being said, we're just going to freestyle from here on one. Eagle One, how are you today?
Well, I'm good. So we couldn't get a guest today. Is that why we're doing this?
Don't out me like that. It's very painful. At least 2 years up there. Well, yeah. Well, the problem is there are some people. I've heard about them. They're pretty rare that I actually run into in my life, but they – it's almost, I think it's a cult. It's some type of pilgrimage. It's called a vacation, and they do things like take their family with them. I don't know. It's a strange problem, but it's interfering with our show, and I guess you and I are not members of said cult, at least not this week. So it's all up to us. And I want to say thanks to a lot of the guys in the chat room who are already there. And gals eventually. I know Mary and Maggie usually show up and chastise everybody for a little bit during the show. But I also got some email questions. And Eagle One, I just wanted to throw this out because, I mean, it's sure generating a lot of heat. I don't know how much light. But the big story of this week is the budget crisis, if you want to call it a crisis. I don't want to. It's kind of like calling aging a crisis. It's going to happen regardless of what you do about it. But it's kind of another chapter in a saga that's going to be going on for a long time. Any economist of any stripe will tell you that the budgetary pressures we're going to see in the next 10 to 20 years are fairly unprecedented. The only time you go to this debt level is after World War II, but that debt was all acquired in fighting a war. And when the war no longer needed to be fought, then you didn't need to have, what was it during World War II, 75% plus of the budget went toward military only. And then you had the post-war boom that took place. We don't have that situation right now. We historically have a relatively small defense budget. So it's going to be interesting to see. But I think the pressure that we've talked about here on the show a few times, I wouldn't say we were ahead of the power curve, but at least we were riding it. And that's going to be the impact on our shipbuilding budget when the only ships we really have in the pipeline are very expensive. And I think we're delusional to think that we're going to have a steady state, especially in real dollars, of a defense budget. So that leaves us with things to build: aircraft carriers, Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, LCS, and a couple of little amphibs like LPD 17 class ship. Eagle One, if you had to throw one of the babies into the volcano, what do you think Navy should probably look at throwing in the volcano first?
Well, I would probably reduce the number. This is hard to say. I'd probably reduce the number of LCS ships. I would take a really hard look at restarting an FFG assembly line, if you will. And we need to take a hard look at what the risks are to us. And I know people have been doing that. We've talked some in the past about the South China Sea. I know that there's also a discussion about some kind of basing of LCS in the Singapore area or some kind of rights out there. But we really need to take a hard look at what it would take for us to support an effort in the South China Sea to help protect those we've committed to protect, like the Philippines and some of our allies down there, like Singapore. How about you?
Is that great discussion that went on? It started, I guess, about 18 months ago, where people were looking at the options of, you know, do you do the steady state reduction? Do you, concentrate on the big ships? Do you get smaller ships, kind of the Jerry Hendricks model? I think, though, in order to pick one of those paths, it's going to require a leader with vision and somebody that, a lot of people have issues of Zumwalt in the early 70s. Nobody's perfect, but it was a guy that was willing to make decisions on what he thought was right and to move things forward. And, at least we got the Fig 7 out of him, amongst other things. But one thing that kind of frustrates me, to do what you talked about, it takes a leader that's willing to both work inside the lifelines and to have the discipline to keep that conversation inside the lifelines, but is also willing to engage outside the lifelines. And two of the major personalities that I thought would at least give us an opportunity to have a conversation as adults in the Navy community was Stavridis and, of course, Harvey. Both of those guys were bypassed for, of course, Admiral Greenert. There are a lot of people who have very strong emotions about Greenert. The only thing that sticks in my mind is he is the guy that is responsible for, you know what, these inserts are really uncomfortable, and because they make me uncomfortable, I just want to classify them. And I don't know if that's the right instinct for what I think we need is a great conversation. I don't think Jerry Hendricks has the right answer. I don't think, the steady cut is the right answer, but I think you did touch on something. It's not just because of my systemic dislike of LCS, but when you look at the frigate designs, it takes a while to design a ship from scratch, and I think that's phase two. But phase one of the operation is we have to maintain our domestic shipbuilding capability, and when you have a significantly shrinking budget, you have to make some compromises in order to get the most bang for your buck, both figuratively and literally. And when I was really feeling gloomy 18 to 24 months ago, I would talk about a 220-ship Navy, knowing that that was an exaggeration. I don't know if that's too much of an exaggeration anymore. So you also need ships that are capable of sailing alone and being ready to engage any potential enemy with some modicum of a multi-mission capability, and you can only get that from some type of patrol frigate. I think of the Euro frigate designs, though there are some limitations, it also has kind of a capability that Spruance had, that it had some extra square footage you could add things on later. I think the Nansen design, if done with appropriate economies of scale that we would do, I think would be a very affordable design. As are the Absalon and the Seven Provinces. But the immediate question that would come back from people is, okay, can you build one of those for the price of an LCS? And I know an LCS plus two mission modules, I think probably you could. And what does that give the component commanders when they have USS, XXX coming across the horizon? Does he have a ship that he's coming to theater and originally thought was going to be doing kind of like what we did with the embargo operations in the Northern Arabian Gulf through the 90s. And then, history changes and all of a sudden there's an air threat that shows up. Okay, is that ship going to have to come back to port and wait 2 weeks for an install team to put a new emission module on it? or can it go up there and start doing at least a rudimentary job until some of the specialty ships come on? But in order to do that, you got to free up funds. I think the long pole in the tent here. And who was it that recently talked about? I think it was Galarin talked about. You know, if we go down to 9 carriers, it's a tipping point, and everybody dies. I don't buy it. I think if we went down to 9 carriers or even 8 carriers in order to save funds and to save money, I don't think that's the end of the world by any way, shape, or form, especially when you compare it to potential adversaries out there. But hard decisions are going to have to be made like that. I think you're going to have to just take out a big chunk. So I would take out a big chunk of that, and I would also look at the 2020s, and I would tell the submarine community, you're probably going to get 8 replacement ballistic missile submarines, maybe 6. A year and a half ago, I was thinking 10, but I think for budgetary reality, and in order to maintain some type of presence in a Navy that works for a two-ocean Navy, that we're going to have to cut funds. So I'm a fan of the piss off as many people as possible frame of mind, and that's be brutal about the aircraft carriers and be a little tough with the take a little bit of global nuclear war risk and cut the ballistic missile submarines down to about 6-8 at the most.
Wow. I'm probably a little more open-minded about the LCS than you, in that there are some aspects of the design that I find really interesting, and given enough time, I suspect some of the maintenance issues and things can be worked out, although I have real questions with the crew. Ken Adams is asking us rather pointedly what mission the frigate, the FFGs, would fulfill in the modern world, what national security strategy element, as he phrases it. And I think I keep pointing to them as a presence ship, in that they have the range, as you said, to go out on their own. They're not limited by a need to either reduce speed to save a lot of fuel. They're still plenty capable of going out and crossing the ocean and all that. And that's, I think, the presence is the key issue in a lot of the things we're dealing with here in the future.
And wasn't that originally, when you look at the frigates of the late 17 and early 1800s, wasn't really that their mission was presence, to get out there and show the flag? They weren't ships of the line, and they were never intended to be the major ship of the line, but they could hold their own, they could do the presence, and they could create effects globally where required in a fairly efficient and, for that age, quick manner.
Yeah, I think that's right. The difficulty is that for me at least, I started out with a much larger Navy, and we've seen it stripped down, and the argument has always been that, yeah, we're smaller, but we're much more competent. But there are a lot of missions that don't require the kind of competencies that we have managed to limit ourselves to at this point. And it'd be nice to have some relatively dumb ships, fairly inexpensive to operate, that could provide a self-supporting presence in areas where we need to have real warships and not just amphibs and no offense to the amphib community, not just hospital ships and things like that. Sometimes you really do have to show a ship out there that has a gun on the front of it.
Exactly, and to try to answer Ken's question as best as possible, I try to put it down to the direction I think we need to go to. And regular readers of my blog, and I haven't mentioned it too often on the show because it's usually about our guests and not me. Pre 9/11, I had this opinion as well. We need to not disengage, but we need to come back home. And we need to be U.S.-based with global reach. And part of that global reach is having our presence known in a way that you got a carrier battle group come across the horizon. That's a great message to send to somebody. But many times you don't want to do that. That's overkill. That's like, going dove hunting with a 10-gauge. Yeah, sure, you can get the job done, but good God, you're overdoing it. And frigates have the ability to do that. And again, almost revising their traditional role of 200 years ago. And again, in a cost-efficient manner that doesn't require too much. It still drives me nuts when we have these beautiful Arleigh Burke-class destroyers off there doing counter-piracy. And on that line, I want to directly engage a comment from Undersecretary Work. He got very, very excited about John Patch's article against LCS back late last year, I believe it was. And over in San Diego, he very emphatically hollered out, "We don't need frigates. This Navy doesn't need frigates. We don't need what they do. If we need frigates, our allies will get them." It's about a 90% direct quote from him. I think maybe we could talk about Libya some later on. But anybody who has studied the performance of the balance of our allies in Afghanistan, with the caveat laden, won't leave the damn front gate or do anything, let the Americans do the dirty work. Look at the Horn of Africa, where you have a commander who has almost two dozen ships, of which he admits in public he can only do anything with five of them. Or you can look off Libya, what's happening there when a lot of our allies are just going home. You know, what if you gave a war and nobody came? What if you needed frigates and nobody offered them to you? Or they offered them to you, but they could only do surveillance. They couldn't do boarding. So are you going to have an LPD-17 doing that type of operations? Are you going to have a multi-billion dollar, what we call destroyer, that's really a light cruiser, doing the functions that could be done by a much more efficient ship? Well, you won't have it. You won't have a choice. And I think there's a lot of people who have a lot emotionally and professionally and reputation-wise invested in this ship. And we're going to wind up with them one way or another. And, continuing to kick the dead horse and to kind of go back to Ken's very important question. What things in our strategy does LCS not do? I said it does not do most of it, because strategy is strategy, but operations and tactics are much more time critical. When you got a ship in theater that is no use to you, all it's doing is taking away logistics from what you can do, unless you're going to wait and wait and wait for them to come and switch out a mission module, which I still think is just a pipe dream. It's not going to work. And a greater kind of shifting away for a second, if you wanted to. Do you have anything you want to say about LCS? Because E-40, our Polish contingent, he had an interesting question he wanted us to touch on as well.
Yeah, no, I think we've beaten LCS to death. I do want to make a plug for the – I think that the – was it Hendrickson's article, Ford's Not Ferraris?
Yes, sir.
You know, that analogy – really works well when you're talking about the need for frigates. You know, I've been watching the TV show Top Gear, and they test all these Maseratis and Lamborghinis and Lord knows what cars that go 350 million miles per hour. But, you know, you're not going to drive one of those down to the local grocery store to pick up a quart of milk. You really need some workhorse vehicle, the Honda Civic or something, so that for your daily use. I mean, it just... And that's what we seem to be getting away from, is having that, in my day at sea, the gearing class destroyer, that could go out there and operate. It had twin screws, and you know, if one thing broke, you could run, you could still go places. And we I don't know why we've evolved away from that fairly simple concept, but we sure have. What's our friend from Poland got?
Yeah, well, I think. Some of that, and this is, you talk to the old F-14 and talk to some of the attack air guys, and I think the service community suffers from something else. There's a lot, the most petty type of parochialism that comes into these arguments. The F-18 mafia and what they did to attack air, turning us back into a post-World War II where we only had, they had carriers full of Hellcats, and that was about it. The service community, the Aegis Mafia, and the lack of respect and not having flag officers in positions to defend communities. And when push comes to shove, they just get really parochial, and that's kind of sad. But what E-40 was talking about, he made a point that really kind of torqued me off. And the reason it torqued me off was because I didn't think of it first. But I'll let you put one of your other hats on with this discussion. When you think about territorial seas, it seems that the historical concept of territorial seas in the modern age is based upon the reach of coastal artillery. If you think about it, 3 miles, 12 miles, it's kind of, that's coastal artillery, where you could actually tell somebody to get off your water. But when you look at China, which is an old nation with new attitudes, I saw a total sidebar here. It was a funny cartoon the other day. It's a guy opening up a fortune cookie, and inside the fortune cookie it just says, "I own you." That with their reach into the South China Sea, it's almost as if they're thinking and basing things on the reach, on the range of anti-ship cruise missiles, anti-ship ballistic missiles, where we want this water because we can enforce it, just like you could in the old days. And how much do you think that is actually driving their push? You have the classic Asian face-saving bolster going on there, but they're actually rudimentary way, building the capacity to actually enforce that from land and never ever having to actually engage you at sea. What do you think of E-40's little thought there?
Yeah, I saw that, and I thought that the initial thought is right, that it was territorial limits were based on the range of the guns from shore. But it's a stretch, I think, to take that into the missile age. Because we've had, and other countries have had, essentially manned missiles for, what did we just celebrate, the 75th anniversary of naval aviation? Is that our 100th anniversary of naval aviation, I guess? Yeah, whoops. How old am I anyway? we could fly out even 80, 90 years ago, well into 200 miles, and we could have enforced it then. So I think that is an interesting thought, but I don't think it's really what's going on. I mean, I think that the claims by China, the very aggressive claims, the cow's tongue, are seem to be driven by, they've got what they allege is their historical basis for them, plus the natural resource thing. But underneath it all, seems to me, it's just another one of those bold attempts that nations occasionally make to stake out a claim that they wonder if anybody will actually push back on it. And we see it, I think, in the North Pole area, where the Russians are claiming that part of their continental shelf area actually extends to the under the North Pole, and that gives them the right to exploit any of the rich mineral in that area. So I just think these are unfortunately fairly typical, rather bold assertions made by states waiting to see if anybody will push back on it, and not caused by the range of the cannon, so to speak.
I think that pushback, especially in the Arctic, because the Russians, rightfully so, I mean, they dominate so much of the Arctic to begin with. And I saw a map the other day that had that little ridge going up, pretty much of a stretch on their part. But you're right, they'll make the claim. I mean, that's how they do business in that part of the world. They'll make a claim, and if you don't like it, push back on it. But then you have very small countries like the Danes, who, because of their relationship with Greenland, if they ever go independent, which would be a country of, 60,000 people, with a huge claim to the Arctic. And you have Norway and Britain have a little take. We actually have a pretty small wedge. It's a big argument for Canada, poor Canada, still trying to make those British submarines working. But it's – the Russians are weak. When you look at their potential competitors – I saw an interesting article the other day going back to our unreliable allies. And a lot of people forget that, you know, countries like Denmark, they're actually very small, you know, in the mid, you know, 5 million, few hundred thousand. Same with Norway, you know, less between 5 and 6 million people. Denmark right now has a fighter fleet of 48, which is respectable. They got elections coming up, and the Socialist Party has put out a paper where they want to decrease that to about 16. If they decrease the Air Force that much, what type of ability does anybody have to bluff the Russians? The Canadians, God bless them, but they're only 33, 34 million people, and the Russians have a demographic fold in. And I don't think anybody who's competing with the Russians have the Russian personality. I don't know how that whole Arctic thing is going to work out. I don't think anybody is going to go to war over it. Famous last words. But I think the interesting thing...
Can you spell Falklands?
Yeah. Anybody want to quote me on that? No, please don't. But there's nothing anybody could do about it. But again, yeah, how do you defend something like that? I don't think any Russian skipper wants to go on a six-month deployment with a submarine under the ice. That probably won't end well. But I think the interesting thing is you have nations that don't have a stake in the Arctic, like the Chinese. You know, talk about not being invited to the party. They're knocking on the door coming in. They're like, what? Well, you're not even a member of the club. So there's a lot of people who are trying to get in on that. I just think that's part of their big resource race that they're going through throughout the world to try to get things going the way they are.
Well, they have staked out a claim in the Arctic. I don't remember the basis of it off the top of my head, but there is some reason they think they have a right to be up there too.
Just because they're one out of five people in the world, and that probably has something to do with it. Besides, present company excluded, just to touch on one of the topics I like to talk with, the unsexy, dull, yet important items, at least for what I would like to see, in having more things, you know, USA-based of global reach, that would require a lot more replenishment ships. And the ability to do what you alluded to earlier is the ability to have some type of endurance out there. I know even during, you know, the Barbary Wars, our frigates were based out of Naples, I believe, and we're replenishing there along with the Swedes, who were our allies for the first year. But with the budget crunch coming as it is, unlike the Air Force, you know, General Schwartz, he was a cargo guy, so he could defend that side. I do not see visibility on anybody in our leadership who actually has a background in logistics. Can you think of any significant flag officers that have that type of background that can argue that confidently?
Hey, do you hear crickets?
You know, that's what would have been nice to see. You know, ideally, I would have liked to send somebody that would at least engage in the conversation, like Harvey or Stavridis. But
you know, one of the things is when I was a young officer and served on an ammo ship, all our oilers, all of our ammo ships, all of our AFSs were officered and crewed by USN sailors. And as a result, many of us who worked in that mobile logistics support force kind of got an idea that logistics were important. And since many of the current flags have grown up, all that stuff has been folded into MSC. The crews are not Navy, but well-trained and excellent civilian mariners with small Navy components on board. But I think that unless some flag officer served on one of those replenishment ships, I don't think they have any experience in how important those ships are, you know, other than every now and then one of them pops up on the horizon and refuels you or rearms you and has that hands-on experience about what it actually takes to get a load out on an ammo ship and drive it to where that stuff is needed. And I think that's a serious shortcoming, the way we train some of our senior officers.
And I know there's a lot of advocates. The usual suspects. Lee is a big advocate of civilian mariners doing that. And I agree with you about the military portion. And here's one of the reasons. You know, there's primary reasons, and there are secondary and third order reasons. A lot of people would go up derisions like, "Who's the CO of that? It's Captain Umpty France. Isn't he a helo guy, or what's a P3 guy there doing the CO, being the CO of a replenishment ship?" But what that does is it takes people who are fairly immune from the requirements that it takes to get ships underway, keep them going, coming back, the maintenance cycles and everything else, and exposes them to that. So in theory, if you're taking your better officers and giving them as much command, another fantasy world of mine, I know, if you're taking your better officers and giving them as much command experience and diversified command experience as possible, what a great way to get your top running rotary wing, shore based aircraft in other communities who don't get exposures to, the Navy part of the Navy, to see what that's like. So in theory, when they get to the 2-star or 3-star level, they can have an in-depth appreciation of that. Or your experience was back during the Napoleonic era when the
Oui, mon Dieu.
Oh, yeah. The wine was much better, I could quite assure you. You had people who had a diversified command background, and it's something that's been lost, and I think that's.
Yeah, and I think the point. I mean, one of my COs was a submariner, and I know a lot of the other AEs had aviators, and I'm sitting here thinking, well, the H-60 Sierra helicopter pilots, many of them do fly off the, they're the military flight crews for the ammo ships and the other ships that go out there, the replenishment ships. But other than that, I'm not sure what other community, Navy community, would have the kind of exposure that I'm talking about, where the guys actually, the CO, because it used to be a jumping point where you had to be CO of an AE, an AO, or an AOE or something before you could even get carrier command.
Yep.
I don't know what other community other than the H-60 Sierra groups are getting that kind of exposure on a regular basis. And to put a fine point on it, back in the old days when we had sails, we didn't worry about refueling much, but this darn fuel we require now, it just drives us all crazy. But that was one of the points of the general board. The show we did in the general board I thought was good, in that the general board really did worry about, if we don't have any bases that we can get to, or their bases are going to be blown up, how are we going to refuel our fleet? And somebody started thinking about underway replenishment. So not that they hadn't done that with Colliers, but back when I was really young, the coal ships, but underway replenishment with fuel oil and stuff, and which really did open up our fleet to be a much more aggressive force than some other countries.
And I'm kind of a U-boat war nut, which is kind of sad, because the U.S. submarine war in the Pacific is just a tremendous story, and that never would have happened if the input of the general board in the design of the submarines, which made them, compared to the German submarines, much larger, much more capable, larger range, larger cruise time. If the German Navy in World War II had our type of submarines, the Battle of the Atlantic would have been very, very, very different, especially when you consider what they did back in 42 and 43 in the Caribbean, even with those small little Type 7 U-boats. Really incredible. Over in the chat room, Paul brought up a good point, and it's true. In one of my previous lives, I used to have a common phrase that usually would stop an argument. I'd say, hey, only two people have veto on this, the Supreme Being and logistics. And in the Army, there is a lot to be said for having, from a promotional standpoint, exposure to logistics. If it looks good on a record, it can help promoting people because you know, you're the irritating guy who knows why it's irritating and knows why how we can't thumb our nose at Pakistan because then everybody starves to death. But on the Navy side of the house, when you look at a lot of the career paths and a lot of the talking, they're not so much focused on the logistics of keeping a fleet forward deployed as much of money. That short-term focus on saving money, and you know, what has that gotten us? You look at what we were talking about, the replenishment ships. Well, we'll just make them all SIVMAR. We don't really need that many. We have fewer. And then you look at the whole argument about decommissioning the Spruances and the Flight 1 Tycos early. Like, oh, well, we're going to retire them early and take that money to recapitalize the fleet. No, we just bought titanium fire mains instead. And then you look at optimal manning, which it was very good to see in the last few months. Navy's come out and has said, oops, sorry, my bad, and is starting to readdress the optimal manning problems, but it's going to take a lot of time and money to repair the damage of that. So we had this focus on short-term money. It really didn't work out that well for us, I don't think. But a total lack of appreciation of logistics. I think that might argue a little bit for why, and I know some of our listeners have more knowledge of this than I do, the future maritime pre-positioning force ships and the whole sea basing concept. And that was so much of that argument and discussion was logistics-based, and I just think in many ways that our senior leadership just was bored with the subject and it never got footing. What have you heard on your end?
Well, I don't think it's bored with that. You know, one of our problems is that unlike the Army, you can be, I guess you can do time in the sort of with the quartermasters in the Army or the Marines, and that doesn't hurt you. But in the Navy, most of our logistics stuff, the contracts, some of the worrying about it is done by our supply corps. And, you know, they're terrific human beings, and we couldn't live without them. But I wonder if that causes us to get really short-sighted from the operational point of view of, you know, how does this stuff really work? Because we tell, you know, our pork chop to go get something done, and it mysteriously shows up where we need it when we need it most of the time. And I just wonder if that is one of those differences that is that makes us maybe less logistics-focused than we should be.
Yeah, could be. It's really, I don't know. It just, you look in it, much smaller fleets that had a lot more balance. It seems that we're not only are we putting more eggs into fewer baskets, but the baskets all seem to have fewer and fewer, lack of a better phrase, diversity of shapes and capabilities. On the air side of the house, I think you have another trend that comes out. And you know, back when I was a young man, when people would talk about joint aircraft, everybody would have a good snicker because the poster child, and I think it's still a good poster child for trying to design a joint aircraft, was the F-111. You know, McNamara's horse designed by committee that, you know, Tom Connolly, Vice Admiral, one issue, had that great phrase, you know, there's not enough thrust in all of Christendom to make it a fighter plane, so the Navy managed to get rid of that. When you look back at the great joint aircraft, they were never designed to be joint to begin with. I think the F-4 is a good example. Even the A-7, the Air Force hated the A-7. But they bought a lot, especially for their Air National Guard folks, and it served them well in Vietnam. Heck, the A-1, speaking of Vietnam, the Air Force made very good work of the A-1. I don't know that the F-35 is really going to make all that great of a joint aircraft, because what the 100-pound heads are telling me is all those design compromises are resulting in an aircraft that just may not be all that it could have been and should have been. And hopefully they'll get the Marine Corps version right, because there is no plan B for VSTOL, either for us or our allies. I know the Brits are kind of hedging their bet with their a Queen Elizabeth class carrier that might be able to take the Charlie version. But the Bravo version, if they can't make that work, it's kind of out of Schlitz to a certain extent. And plus, you don't have the internal gun on the Bravo and Charlie either for that. I mean, when you look at joint programs, you know, try to find the sunny side of life for me here, Eagle One. Can you think of a joint weapons program that actually has worked?
Oh, well, I think the H-60, which is, I don't remember what the Army name of it is, but I mean, that, you know, that from our point of view, the Black Hawk helicopters actually worked fairly well.
Isn't that kind of like the F-4, though, where it didn't start out as a joint program, and the Navy just said, hey, that's pretty good, let's navalize that?
Yeah, which, you know, I have no problem with that. They just made it a little, I guess we made it a little longer and stiffened some of the stuff, yeah, so it would land on ships. I'm trying to think of another one. I mean, a lot of the joint weapon system. You know, I've always been amazed, as was my father-in-law, who was an Army armor officer, that we have not gotten together with the Army on some of the artillery components of our forces. And I know that there was some discussion at one point about using the multi-launch
MRLS,
rocket system.
Multiple rocket
there we go. You know, that kind of fell through at some point for reasons that I haven't really fully understood and probably never will. But, no, I can't think of too many. Well, let me, you know, the most basic component that we do have in common with all our brethren are the GE gas turbine engines that are used.
Yep.
For everything, and you know, and I think it's not a weapon as per se, but it sure has proved to be a pretty good system as it works out.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of that would be as a byproduct that another service comes up with something that meets their requirements, because you only have one cook in the kitchen, so to speak. They can produce a pretty good product, and then another service can go, that kind of works for me. Let's tweak it a little bit. And all for running, you know, we even look at the only pointy nose aircraft we have, the F-18. That just was the loser on the fly off with the F-16. It's an Air Force airplane that was modified to be good enough to go off a carrier deck. And, you know, here we are with that's pretty much all we've got. I know there was also really our rotary wing guys will probably salivate for it. But there's also there was a navalized version of the Seahawk that was going to make it almost like an Apache, which is pretty sexy. And they tried to build off, but that was pretty much nixed because it couldn't carry cargo or swimmers. But there, I think there's something to be said for letting a service build something that meets its needs and if it's good enough to go forward. I think in the short term, it may cost more per unit, but I think as long as they didn't put the same people in charge of it, they put in charge of the Osprey. If you told the Marines, okay, go find a replacement for the Harrier, get together with the Brits, and they'll go figure it out, they probably would have come up with something that would probably be cost competitive, a little better than the F-35. And who knows, they might have even come up with an aircraft that was better for some people's services and overseas partners. I know a big concern with the F-35 has always been kind of that fetish that people overdo with stealth. You know, maybe the replacement for the Harrier, they would have decided they wanted to emphasize something else besides stealth, and it might have met other people's need at a better price. Because you look at the Harrier, it's got, you know, 30 millimeters of love everywhere it goes, regardless of what its other loadout is. But now the Marines are going to be stuck with an aircraft, and unless somebody has looked into the future and lashed on a gun pod, it could be on top of Marines and not even be able to do the most accurate close air support you can do, which is a strafing run that we've seen in Afghanistan over and over and over again. So I kind of wish we could give the services a little more run for their money to try to develop what meets their needs best, and then maybe other people can play off of it.
Well, you make a good point. I mean, I was sitting here thinking as I talked about the H-60 that was kind of a success. But then I start talking to the H-60 Sierra pilots and who are familiar with the cargo capabilities of the H-3. With the H-3 was not as capable an aircraft in many ways, but carried more cargo and longer cargo. And for example, if you need to replace a aircraft turbine, I think the H-3s could carry them, but the H-60 they won't fit as an internal load. I'm speaking totally off the top of my head on that, but that is an issue. So, all right, looks like we have a caller. All right.
Yep, and I think I know who this is, but if you just called in to listen in, tough, you're going to have to ask us a question. So, hey, area code 904, we've got you on the line. Do you have a question for us?
Yes, this is your friend Lee C. I've got three observations. Sorry, I just dialed in late, but here are three observations.
Yes, sir.
Number one, I think one of the most interesting supposedly joint aircraft programs going on right now is the C-27J Spartan, which, you know, the Army wants and needs, but management was switched over to the Air Force who doesn't want it. And guess what? The program got cut by about half when the Air Force got it. So that's a joint program that has questionable future to it. I'm sorry I got in late, but I saw Ken's comments about the T-ships. Here's a little bit of information for you. I just got told that the MSC is being asked to look at cutting fleet oilers, TAOEs, and even some of the other ships that were mentioned, which goes to show you that the tactical sea lift part of MSC, which is the Naval Fleet Auxiliary Force, is low-hanging fruit. There's also been some other comments about, you know, what do we need oilers for when we can, when we're losing ships? Of course, you know the answer to that. I just want to give you those two tidbits.
Well, Lee, let me ask you a question here. You know the T-ships pretty well. I know you probably missed this early part of the conversation. I think we actually used your name in vain once before you showed up to defend yourself. But that's just absolutely insane when we all know the actual need is the opposite, especially if we wind up losing bases for one reason or another. But the TAOEs and others, what are their ages and their conditions right now? So if we start decommissioning things, are these something that would have fallen off the conveyor belt in a few years? Or are these ships that actually are in pretty good shape and have more life left in them?
The Kaiser-class fleet oilers are not gone. They're getting older. They need updating. There was a request to update them, and OPNAV turned them down and says, no, we're not going to update the existing ships. We want to go out and buy new TAOXs. And, oh, by the way, it's going to take us 4 years to do that. And that was even after they moved up the ship buying, the ship ordering sequence for them. The TAOE, the spy class, the gas turbine driven AOEs, are getting a little long in the legs and have some significant engineering problems, which they're gradually overcoming. There are a number of people within the MSC Civmar community who say, hey, our job is to take old Navy ships and keep them running longer.
Well, let me ask you this, Lee, because we were discussing, I think before you popped up, at least in the chat room, the lack of experience in our senior Navy officer corps with logistics. And is this potential reduction of the logistics forces, is that a sign of that, or is it this fact that this is a transcom issue now because they've got control of these ships? Where exactly does this come from? And I mean, do these people understand what this does to the capabilities of the fleet if they reduce these assets?
The origins go back in that transportation was seen as a subset of logistics, and logistics was the domain of the Supply Corps. There were not many line officers going to Supply Corps schools. I made it to a couple of them because I was an MSC officer. But most officers, line officers, aviation or surface, don't have a good deal of training in the defense transportation system, the the formal system and how it functions. It was made worse by the fact that at one point in time, MSC had naval officers all the way down to the lieutenant level at their subordinate command spread around the world. Back in one of the cutbacks when Vice Admiral Holder was there, he gave up all of those billets from about commander level down to lieutenant level. We don't. MSC has no way of growing officers who are skilled in the transportation business. We take what we get. If you go look at the bios of the O6s who are at the squadron level and at the area command level, you ain't going to see any transportation in their background. They just come over from the fleet.
Yeah, that's such an incredible loss. Having worked in a combined and joint headquarters, is you would call over to the J4 shop and say, hey, I need somebody to help us update this project. And you get the loggy to walk through the front door. It's a U.S. Army guy with a Ranger tab. He's led troops in combat on more than one tour, but he's my loggy. You know, it's a very, very different mindset from other sources. And I think a lot of that may have to do with the fact that they do have line officers that also have significant and almost specialized experience in logistics. For instance, if you had an Aegis guy or a guy who was a FRS instructor who was an F-18 guy, he called his detail and was like, hey, I really, really want to go get a master's degree in logistics. They sent him to get an MRI to see whether he had a stroke. And they told him that's career suicide. But you don't see that in our other services, and I think that's kind of the one of the unsexy things. Hey, let me ask you a question there, being that you're last time we had you on a caller, I think we let you call one time a year, Lee. I don't know how this works. But one thing we haven't given enough love to on the show, if you could give them a couple minutes, talk about some of the people that you have some experience with. I believe you're with the Navy League up in Northeast Florida or Mayport. Is that correct?
I'm a Navy League Mayport, yeah.
Yeah, what all does the Navy League do up there in Mayport with its interface with the Navy and the community that you'd like for people to know about?
The Navy League councils at the port level, if you will, interact very directly with all the commands. We see the COs, et cetera, of all the services at the Navy League. They support functions such as sailor of the quarter, sailor of the year. They do, for instance, when the ships come back to Mayport, there's one coming back Wednesday. The Navy people show up at the pier to welcome the sailors back and help their families, as the case may be. And at the national level, which I'm not as familiar with, they have many, many high-level contacts that helps the Navy get the word out as to what their program is, or which way the Navy in the big picture is going.
Is that the only besides the Navy League they have there in Mayport? Are there other Navy leagues up and down the coast nearby, or
yes,
are you pretty much all
yes
there is between Miami
no
and North?
No. There are in the Northeast. Northeast Florida region, we have Mayport. We have Navy leagues at Mayport, at Jacksonville, at St. Augustine, and another one further down the coast. I want to say Port Canaveral, Fort Lauderdale, something like that. But they're pretty well spread out.
And I think that's pretty much replicated all over the place.
Yes,
I know one of the people I communicate with on a regular basis, he's really involved with the Navy League over in San Francisco, another down in San Diego, and I just thought that would be an opportunity to meet everybody that if they wanted to get involved with the Navy community in some way, maybe in a little more depth, to go online, look up Navy League, see where your nearest chapter is, and find out where they spend their time.
Let me just make one other observation.
Sure.
That people may not be aware of. The Civil Service Mariners who operate the Navy Fleet Auxiliary Force ships, these guys, it is nothing for a master to have command 10 or 15 times in a 20-year period. It's nothing for a chief engineer to go to stay on the same class of ship for 10 years. These gents become extremely knowledgeable, not only about the ships they're driving, the classes they're driving, and the missions they perform, but I've had one Civ Mar master who was a flea oiler in the Persian Gulf tell me that he was a de facto logistics group coordinator, and he didn't have a squadron staff to help him. It was him, himself, and his cargo officer who were lining up all the ships all the way up and down the Persian Gulf at that particular point in time. So these guys are doing not only ship driving, but they're doing the transportation officer bit that used to be run by squadron staffs.
Well, Lee, thanks for calling in, and have a great week.
All righty. I'll be staying in the chat room.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Lee.
And coming back for a second, we just got a few more minutes to go here. You know, one thing that Lee mentioned, the C-27 Spartan, I actually been watching that from afar because it's, it looks like a C-130, but it just has two engines. But they actually have a roll-on, roll-off gunship version of that I believe even the Marine Corps was looking at because it has a pretty small footprint to deploy, and it would be little and is a little more flexible than a C-130 gunship, because I know the Marines have converted some of their C-130s to a little bit of a gunship. Nice little capability, but again, it's one of those things that just didn't have the right support one way or another. Eagle One, let me throw you this way here while we have a couple more minutes left here. What do you have coming down the line over on your blog, Eagle Speak, this week that you're going to be talking about?
You mean you think I plan ahead?
I was hoping somebody would, because I just go, okay, I got 5 minutes to finish my coffee. What am I going to blog about today?
Well, I depends on what time of the morning I get up. I'm still looking at the monsoon, which has been affecting the pirates in the Indian Ocean, is going to come to an end fairly soon. I would expect a spike in that. I've got some thoughts on. On the ethanol issue, which should be a matter of national security interest for us, and just some other things. I do see here that Tom Gorey wants to talk about retirement under the DOD budgets. Do you see, unlike people like you and me who are getting paid directly by the taxpayers in retirement, are the new incoming people going to have to get 401ks or what?
I've talked about this on my blog a little bit. Back at the Milbog conference in 2010 that I went to up in D.C., they had a panel up there that was talking about manpower, and I stood up and I said, okay, you haven't talked about this, but I'm going to ask you. I was like, here's what they do with the European militaries. A lot of these people, they don't see retirements till age 55. And I went through a few other things about retirement costs. So when do we address that? And they didn't want to address it because it's so uncomfortable. If there is an ensign or a JG right now who thinks he's going to have anything approaching the same package of people who are retiring right now, they're delusional. Hope for the best, plan for the worst, save, save, save. All your combat tax exclusion money, if you're spending that, not investing that, you're a fool. Okay, spend 20% of it, save 80% of it. Anything you can do when you get a bonus, if you're not putting 80% of that away, then you're a fool. You've got to prepare because it's going to get so ugly in the next 20 years from a money standpoint, and it's nothing personal, it's all business. And I think even the older retirees, best case scenario, they're going to work the COLA magic where your retirement is just not going to keep pace with the cost of living. And you need to accept that simply because we're broke in a way our nation hasn't been broke in living memory, and significant changes are going to have to be made.
Yeah, I think those are all spot on, and I wish that this lecture ought to be given to everybody who gets recruited right now. You know, don't look at this as a place where you're going to suck on the benefits for the rest of your life. Some of those things that we've given out before are not going to be there when it's time for you to retire.
You know, you'll always have the real loud one or two people who will whine, but for the other 85 to 90% of them, talk to them as adults, treat them like adults, and they'll act that way. We need to have an adult conversation about it.
Yes, we do.
And I think we're about 6 seconds out. So thanks, everybody. Thanks, Eagle One. And we'll see you next time on MidRaps.
Well, thank everybody for showing up today. Have a good week.
It's a long way to Tipperary.